on this edition for Saturday, June 12th. With the G7 summit underway, President Biden focuses on policy priorities, survivors of the Pulse nightclub shooting 5 years later, and artist Tristan Eaton making his mark on a large scale. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. President Biden and the leaders of the world's wealthiest democracies focused on China and aid to developing nations at the second day of the Group of Seven summit in Cornwall, England today. The group announced a $40 trillion infrastructure plan for developing nations, what the White House is calling the Build Back Better World Partnership, to compete with China's Belt and Road Initiative. President Biden also urged allies to join him in calling out China's forced labor practices. In addition to group meetings, Mr. Biden and French President Emmanuel Macron met today for their first in-person discussion.
I think it's great to have the U.S. president part of the club and very willing to cooperate. And I think that what you demonstrate is that leadership is partnership.
The United States, I've said before, we're back. The U.S. is back. We feel very, very strongly about the cohesion of NATO.
The leaders of the seven nations and the European Union are holding mostly private, closed sessions. Outside, thousands of protesters demanding action on climate change and other issues took to the streets and beaches of nearby towns. NewsHour White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor is traveling with President Biden, and she joined us with the latest from Plymouth. Yamiche, was the tone different for this G7 meeting than when President Trump attended?
This was absolutely different in tone. President Biden, for his first foreign trip as commander-in-chief, really was friendlier. It was a much more cordial meeting. And we saw elbow bumping instead of elbow pushing, right? We remember when former President Trump came here and literally elbowed European leaders out of the way. So you really have a lot of European leaders saying that they're happy that the U.S. is now cooperating again. You have the French president in particular mentioning that this demonstrates that there's really leadership and partnership. There are still, of course, some disagreements among the European leaders and the United States. But overall, what you see is President Biden saying there's a lot more talk of shared values, of democratic values, on climate change, on humanitarian rights, on trade even. So I think overall what you see here is a real family reunion, which means that there is a lot of love, but there is still some drama.
Yeah. Well, how are these nations planning on dealing with the challenge that the entire planet is facing right now, the vaccine situation?
Well, the pandemic, of course, is one of the top priorities of the Biden administration and this G7 and these European leaders that President Biden is meeting with. And what we hear from the White House in particular is that they're trying to move past the Trump era. And by doing that, what they're trying to do is show that America has action and really has its arms around the pandemic. And we saw the G7 come out saying that they're going to pledge 1 billion number of doses, coronavirus doses, to nations who need it. And half of them, 500 million will be coming from the United States. So you see here the U.S. President Biden saying that they're taking a lead on this vaccine donation. But I should also note that the U.S. was facing pressure to donate more vaccines. And there was also some talk of the fact that because the U.S. prioritized defense, the Defense Production Act and domestic production, that upset the global supply chain when it came to the vaccinations.
Tell us a little bit about those issues that people do not see eye to eye on yet. I mean, they might be friendly and cordial, but what's happening in some of these private discussions between leaders where they're butting heads?
Well, there are definitely a couple places where leaders are butting heads or at least disagreeing. One of the big ones is China. President Biden is really trying to push to call out China by name in writing at the end of this G7 in the communique. He wants to talk about forced labor and call them out for humanitarian reasons. There's also real issues about trade. I've had some European experts tell me that there's a real question among a lot of European leaders' minds about whether or not President Biden's Buy American is very different from former President Trump's Make America Great and America First agenda. Another thing to note is Afghanistan. President Biden is seen by some as having pulled out too quickly from Afghanistan and not including European leaders, but there are some European leaders who are welcoming the idea of pulling out because they went in trying to back up the United States after, of course, 9/11.
The president is supposed to have later in this week a meeting with Vladimir Putin, and that's consequential for a lot of reasons. But what is the White House saying at this point that will be on the table, that will be discussed?
Well, President Biden is saying that the chief goal when he sits down with the Russian president next week is to really show that America is in a strong position and that we're going to take a firmer stance toward Russia. He really wants to break away from what former President Trump was doing, which was really being seen by most critics as too cozy to Russia. Let's remember that former President Trump at one point said that he believed Russia over U.S. intelligence agencies. So there's also this talk, though, among White House aides that I talked to, that there is this kind of lowering of expectations. There are no hard deliverables that the White House is saying is going to come out of this. But still, ransomware attacks, the ones that were carried out by criminal gangs reportedly in Russia, is definitely going to be top on the agenda. So is humanitarian rights and Ukraine and Russia annexing part of Ukraine. So there's a lot to talk about, a big agenda with a lot of challenges ahead.
NewsHour White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor joining us from Plymouth in the United Kingdom. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Hari.
For more on the G7 summit and the latest international and national news, visit pbs.org/newshour. At least 14 people were wounded in a shooting on a crowded street in Austin, Texas, early today. The incident took place in Austin's busy downtown 6th Street Entertainment District at around 1:30 this morning. As of early this afternoon, two of the injured were in critical condition and authorities were still searching for two unidentified suspects. Officials believe there was a fight between two people and that they were not targeting others caught in the gunfire. Austin police are asking for help from the public and those who may have cell phone videos of the incident. Commemorations are underway today in remembrance of the victims and survivors of the Pulse nightclub mass murder. 5 years ago today, a gunman opened fire on the gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, killing 49 people and injuring more than 50. At the time, it was the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history and immediately prompted calls for gun safety legislation. In a statement released today, President Joe Biden called the Pulse nightclub hallowed ground and said he will sign a bill in the coming days designating the location as a national memorial. For more on the Pulse nightclub shooting half a decade later, Yvette Feliciano recently spoke with two survivors of that attack about how they're coping after the tragedy and the work they're doing to prevent future gun violence.
In the early morning of June 12, 2016, Patience Carter, now Patience Murray, joined the ever-growing list of Americans whose lives are forever changed by a mass shooting.
I wasn't supposed to make it out of that club. I know the final bullet was meant for me. The final bullet was definitely meant for me before the police came through that wall. So that was no accident, and that was divine timing.
Patience Murray and her friends Tiara Parker and Akira Murray were at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Around 2 a.m., a gunman armed with a handgun and semi-automatic rifle opened fire in the club, killing 49 people. Patience Murray was shot twice in the leg, and her friend Tiara suffered a gunshot wound to the stomach. Akira Murray didn't make it out that day. We first spoke to Murray a year after the shooting, and she was struggling with survivor's guilt. But 5 years since the incident, Murray says her faith has helped her get to a better place.
This five-year anniversary hits different in a lot of different ways because this is the first year that I truly feel present for it and truly grateful to be alive.
In the time since the shooting, Murray has written a book about her experience at Pulse, Survive, Then Live, and spoke with federal lawmakers about enacting stricter gun laws. She currently serves as the outreach director for the Gun Violence Survivors Foundation. And she's not the only survivor whose life has been shaped by the shooting. Brandon Wolf was also at Pulse Nightclub that fateful morning, along with his friend Christopher Andrew Leinonen and Leinonen's partner Juan Ramon Guerrero. Wolf was the only one to make it out alive.
How do these anniversaries land for you emotionally?
There always seems to be one moment where it hits me. My best friends and I call it the ugly cry moment, where the weight of the anniversary falls on your shoulders and you really start thinking about the people that you lost. And I'll be honest with you, I was in New York City this week and my flight to New York City was my ugly cry moment. So I'm a ball of emotions.
But Wolf has turned his tragedy into action. In 2016, Wolf launched the Drew Project in honor of his friend Andrew Leinonen. The organization supports LGBTQ youth across the nation through scholarships and providing funding for gay-straight alliances. In 2019, his activism led him to work for Equality Florida, the largest civil rights organization in the state focused on LGBTQ issues. Following the Pulse shooting, Equality Florida began to advocate for gun policy reforms.
I really appreciate that the organization has built a gun violence prevention lens into the work that we do because gun violence is an LGBTQ issue. We know that violence against the LGBTQ community is all too common. We know that Black trans women in this country are targeted disproportionately, and that becomes deadly. It becomes fatal when you add a gun into the mix. So for us, the work is about disarming dangerous people. It's about common sense gun safety reforms that a majority of Americans agree on.
The same year he joined Equality Florida, he testified before the House Ways and Means Committee, calling for gun safety reform.
America is done with talk. They really, really want to see some action come from this body.
Since his testimony, Congress has yet to pass any meaningful gun reform legislation. Despite this, Wolf continues to call attention to issues impacting gun violence survivors. Last week, Wolf and Equality Florida criticized the state's governor, Ron DeSantis, who cut $900,000 in programs serving LGBTQ people, including $150,000 in funding for a local assistance center that provides support for those impacted by the Pulse shooting.
There are currently 68 families or survivors or first responders who are being served by the Orlando United Assistance Center. They receive mental health resources, they receive employment resources, legal resources. All 68 of those families, survivors, and first responders will lose that care if the funding isn't there. That's the real tangible impact.
Wolf sees this as a setback, but says he's not done fighting.
I am deeply tired that I have to continue to relive my trauma like a tap dance for the country, begging for them to hear the things that I'm asking for and to take action on them. But don't mistake my fatigue for inaction, because though I may be tired, though my feet may hurt at the end of the day, I made a promise that I would never stop fighting for the world that Drew would be proud of, and I'm going to make good on that promise.
For Patience Murray, observing the anniversary of when so many people lost their lives looks a little different now than it did a year after the shooting. That's because in 2020, she married the brother of her friend Akira Murray, the youngest victim of the Pulse shooting.
I allow my husband to lead us, and I allow him to guide us in which way that he wants to memorialize his sister and the rest of the 49. And for myself, so if I could just figure out a little bit more and more and more what God is trying to show me, you know, that's the best way that I could spend that anniversary to me.
Saudi Arabia announced today it will restrict the annual Hajj pilgrimage to its own citizens and residents for a second year in a row due to the coronavirus pandemic. The government also set a maximum of 60,000 participants for the week-long Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, down from about 2 million visitors in past years. Only people between 18 and 65 will be able to attend, and all will need to be vaccinated. The kingdom's health ministry says it wants to prevent the spread of the new virus variants between the pilgrims and around the world. Next month in Southern California, the Long Beach Museum of Art will open all at once, a 25-year retrospective of artist Tristan Eaton. Described as an urban pop artist, Eaton's work moves between guerrilla street art, commercial design, civic installation, and fine art. And as NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker recently learned, Eaton has long lived outside of convention.
For this mural on New York City's Fifth Avenue to work for the artist Tristan Eaton, he says it must successfully cater to two audiences.
I want to paint a work of art that has impact when you drive by at 40 miles an hour and you just get a quick glimpse. It has to work that way. But I'd like there to be more for the person that will spend more time with it and engage with it and learn about it.
There are many places across the globe where this can happen. In New York City, in Berlin, Los Angeles, Paris, even Guam.
And when you drive through a city of cinder blocks and brick and concrete and drab grays and browns, and you see a giant pop of color, it's a reminder that anything's possible.
For Eaton, this possible was born of a childhood spent relocating. As a child, he moved from Los Angeles to London and then Detroit.
Being a new kid all the time is it does a powerful job on your brain, you know, that's for sure. I feel like the greatest thing I learned is the hustle. You know, finding a way to adapt and overcome and reinvent yourself and adapt to changes.
But at 16, Eaton's reinvention started to coalesce. His family's move to Detroit was a fortuitous stop for a kid falling in love with graffiti. The city's abandoned buildings provided an open canvas, while the breakdown of a once mighty industrial city, a narrative for his developing aesthetic.
And the abandoned buildings were a canvas for me to go off. And that's been a big storyline in my life, is giving myself as many tools as possible so I can get the ideas out of me in a way that does them justice.
After high school, Eaton moved to New York to study at the School of Visual Arts, where slowly his career began to take shape.
You know, I worked in a factory, I worked in a restaurant, I worked as an art mover. I did everything I had to do to get by, man. And there was comfort in knowing, like, it doesn't matter, because the thing that means the most to me is my art, and that will continue no matter what else is happening.
In the early days, his career took shape not with murals, rather toys. In 2002, he co-founded Kid Robot, a designer toy company where Eaton would design what's known as the Dunny and the Money, both of which now sit in the Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection. But it's the mural work that has caught the rest of the world's attention. What does public art, at the scale that you work in, what does that offer a city and a community?
Well, to be honest with you, it's extremely hard to quantify and so subjective. But when I go to paint in a city like Detroit or cities that don't get as much public art funding or much attention, people can feel heard, they can feel valuable, they can feel unforgotten. And that alone is extremely important. You know, every so often we'll paint a mural and then that mural becomes an intrinsic part of that community and a landmark, and no one will ever let it get painted over. And that's how I know we've done a good job.
Do you find that as you've gained success and notoriety, does that anxiety, for lack of a better word, anxiety to understand and to fit in with the space you're in, has that remained?
No, because I had to grapple with that early. I had a lot of years with no success and no money. And what helped me through all of that, it still helps me to this day, which is that all the external accolades and where you fit in the world and how successful you are has nothing to do with the quality of the art you're making. And I found that it was easier for me to focus if I just realized that all I had to do was put my head down and do good work. And eventually the world will come if the work is good enough.
From the commercial to the inspirational, the world did come for Eaton. And in May of last year, SpaceX wanted to know if Eaton had any interest in his work leaving the world.
There was some empty cargo space in the shuttle, in the capsule. And they didn't know what to do with it, and they were thinking about sending some art into space. And did I have any ideas? What did I think?
Eaton had 1 week to deliver, his past once again informing the present.
Well, I used to have a secret identity called Trusto, and we used to fabricate fake street signs by the hundreds and put them up through cities, and they would just say ludicrous, absurd stuff just to mess with people. So I kind of have this history of working with metal street signs, and laser etching the street signs applies no paint and no extra material that could, you know, be flammable in any way. So I thought that was the method of production. And that could be turned around really fast. And the laser etching process can execute really beautiful detail.
So in addition to adorning the world's cities, Eaton's work has now been to space.
There's no rules, man. You know what I mean? Like, whoever tells you there's rules, you know, you should yell at them. There's no rules. You know, I came from a place where I didn't think I was going to have any success. I didn't think a life in art was possible. So if I met the 20-year-old version of me, I probably wouldn't believe anything I had to say. But I hope that it's inspiring to, you know, younger artists out there who probably have a hard deck of cards dealt to them right now. You know, a lot of people are struggling. And, you know, being an artist is an independent venture. You know, you don't have a union. You don't have health insurance most of the time. So I'm hoping that it's a beacon to, you know, artists out there that, you know, you just do the good work and it'll come eventually.
Finally tonight, the winning bid to ride into space briefly with Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and his brother Mark is $28 million.
13. That's the way to anticipate. Johnny at 13 million and now 14 million.
In a live online auction this afternoon, the price of the seat on the new Shepard jumped up by millions in just minutes.
Sold, $28 million.
2, 1...
The spaceship is scheduled to lift off from West Texas on July 20th. The approximately 11-minute flight will take the crew into space territory and then return to Earth with a reusable rocket. The top bidder's identity will be announced in the next few weeks, along with a still-to-be-named fourth crew member. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.